Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the campaign trail last Friday, George Bush taunted John Kerry, asking if, knowing what we know now, Senator Kerry would have supported going to war with Iraq. Yesterday, in Arizona, Kerry answered, yes, he said, he would still have voted to authorize the war. And then he had some questions of his own for George Bush. But the yes is still ringing and raising the question why. Tonight on Point, the political calculation and costs of John Kerry's embrace of his green light vote for the war in Iraq. We'll hear from political analysts Ralph Nader and you. But first, we begin tonight with the Iraqi city of Najaf, where U.S. forces are locked in what may be a climactic struggle with militants loyal to the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Chris Albritton is Time Magazine's correspondent in Baghdad. I asked him to describe the scene today in Najaf.
Well, last we hear is that tanks have moved into the Walid al-Salam, Valley of Peace Cemetery in Najaf. It's a very holy site for the world Shiites. Najaf in general is a holy place for the world Shiites. Fighting is intense. Hundreds of fighters have been killed, Mahdi Army fighters, according to the U.S. Army. Things are intense down there. There's also fighting here in Baghdad in various neighborhoods, Sadr City especially, also in New Baghdad and other neighborhoods. It's a tense situation.
This has been going on for several days now. Is it getting better or worse? Where does this conflict appear to be headed?
I think it's heading for a climax, actually. Muqtada has said that he will fight to the last drop of his blood, and he has urged his supporters to continue fighting after he is gone, after he's dead. So there seems to be a bit of an apocalyptic mindset among his fighters who are, they're just ready to die. They're ready to go. And there's going to be a lot of dead Shiites by the time this is over.
We hear that American patrols are going through the streets of Najaf today, telling militants to get out of the city or face death. Where do they want them to go? Is it just to leave Najaf or to actually put down their arms and surrender?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, they want them to lay down their arms and surrender. Failing that, they would prefer them to get out of Najaf. Najaf is very politically touchy. It's kind of equivalent to the Vatican to the world's Shiites, and it's a very holy city. Imam Ali's shrine is there, and they definitely do not want to be fighting around the shrine. So when they tell them to get out, it's basically a means of saying, get out so we can kill you somewhere else.
This spring, U.S. commanders promised to capture or kill Muqtada al-Sadr. They backed off of that later when they got into a truce with him that was put together by other Iraqis. Today, we're reading senior U.S. military officers saying that Muqtada al-Sadr himself is still not a target. We are not actively pursuing him, they're saying. Yet, Chris, you're talking about this all moving toward a climax. What might the climax be if it's not the capture or death of Muqtada al-Sadr? Where might it climax?
It will climax with the death or capture of Muqtada al-Sadr. When the U.S. says that he's not a target, they're basically giving Prime Minister Alawi breathing room, who keeps saying that he wants to engage Muqtada in the political process, but really, they don't.
So what's the backstory here? What's the strategy? They've decided it's time to crush Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army? Can they actually pull that off? And if they do, with what consequence?
If Muqtada al-Sadr is killed, I would not want to be in Sadr City. It will explode. It will be a bloodbath. The poor and dispossessed Shiites of the region, they follow him. His kind of movement is one of kind of urban poor. It's one of despair, and I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but the capture or killing of Muqtada is probably necessary from an American standpoint for their strategic plans, but at the same time, it will be a very climactic kind of moment that will send the region's Shiites, and not all of them, but Muqtada's followers, into the spasm of rage that will then eventually die out.
But you're indicating that the interim government, headed by Prime Minister Alawi, appears to be backing this American drive to roll over the Mahdi army and Muqtada al-Sadr.
Alawi's government has given the go-ahead to attack the Imam Ali shrine if the Americans need to. The Americans have always said that they respect places of worship, and under the Geneva Conventions, they are exempt from attack. But when they are used to launch attacks from, they cease being protected spaces. And by all accounts, that's what's happened in Najaf and Karbala. The Mahdi army has holed up in the shrines of Imam Ali and Imam Hussein. They're attacking from these shrines. They have sniper positions at these shrines. Under the Geneva Conventions, they have forfeited the protection that these places of worship would have been accorded before.
Meanwhile, the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, more moderate than Muqtada al-Sadr and far superior in the Shiite world of clerics, is out of the country. How is his absence factoring into this? He's in the U.K. getting medical treatment, we're told. How does that play out?
Well, it's not only Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. It's also Ayatollah Bashar al-Najafi, who is also out of the country. He is, I believe, in Kuwait. He's kind of a lieutenant to Ayatollah Sistani. They are both out of the country, and it's making a peaceful resolution much more difficult. There's all sorts of theories kind of swirling around that Sistani was spirited out of the country because either Muqtada had threatened to abduct him or occupy his offices, or that there was worry that he would be killed in the fighting or injured in the fighting, and so he was spirited out of the country under the pretense of a heart condition, but no one really knows what that story is. All we know is that he is out of the country, his voice is absent from the dialogue, and it's making things a lot more difficult. However, in all fairness, he's been extraordinarily quiet over the past couple of months and has not stepped forward to really put the leash on Muqtada. He may not have said anything anyway, even if he were in the country.
So things moving towards some kind of climactic finale, at least one phase of things in Iraq with the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Chris Albritton, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Chris Albritton is a correspondent with Time magazine. He spoke with us from Baghdad. Bad pre-war intelligence, no WMD, and no substantive al-Qaeda connection. That is a combination that is making many Americans, including many prominent politicians, rethink the vote that authorized President Bush to go to war with Iraq. Kansas Republican Senator Pat Roberts says he doesn't know how he would vote now. Indiana Republican Senator Dick Lugar says the vote would have been different. Dianne Feinstein of California, John Breaux of Louisiana, and Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia all say they would reverse their vote if they could. But not the Democratic nominee for president, Senator John Kerry. Standing yesterday on the rim of the Grand Canyon, Kerry said for the first time that even if he knew then what everyone knows now about Iraq, he would still have voted a green light for the war.
Yes, I would have voted for the authority. I believe it was the right authority for a president to have. But I would have used that authority, as I have said throughout this campaign, effectively. I would have done this very differently from the way President Bush has.
Irresistible political fodder for the Bush reelection machine. Today in Pensacola, Florida, the Republican incumbent expressed ironic appreciation for the Kerry comments, even as he got in another jab on the flip-flop charge.
I want to thank Senator Kerry for clearing that up. Although there are still 84 days left in the campaign.
And in those 84 days until November 2nd, the Iraq War, the decisions, votes, and politics leading to it remains front and center. It is a highly contentious, politically explosive issue. Bush is sticking to his guns. Kerry is sticking to his vote. Tonight on Point, John Kerry's fresh embrace of his vote to authorize the Iraq War, why the senator won't stand down, and what his stand means in the race for the White House. You can join the conversation. How do you interpret John Kerry standing firm on his Iraq War vote? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Newton, Massachusetts, is Dan Payne, Democratic strategist and media consultant who has worked on John Kerry's past Senate campaigns. Dan Payne, great to have you back.
Good to be here.
With us from Washington tonight is Peter Kanellis, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Peter Kanellis, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, great to have you.
Hello, Tom Loder, our guest.
Jack, I'm going to turn first to you tonight, changing our protocol here. You heard and read, like a lot of other people, John Kerry standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon saying, by golly, I would do today just what I did then with that vote, despite everything we've learned since then. What was your reaction? What's the reaction you've been hearing today, Jack?
Well, he was on the rim of the Grand Canyon. I was on the rim of my bed, and I nearly fell over when I heard him say that. I just couldn't believe my ears. It seems to me that that was mindless and or dishonest, craven and impolitic. Mindless, because if he's telling the truth, then he's as impervious to reality as George Bush. Or dishonest, he's saying it. But he doesn't really believe it. He's saying it just because he, you know, for votes, and craven, because it so clearly is an effort to just hug Mr. Bush as closely as he can so that Bush can't get at him on Iraq. And then impolitic because, you know, he's just ripped up one of the strongest cards he had against Bush. And he is given the Ralph Nader candidacy a fillip here that they're going to take advantage of. After all, it was only 527 votes in Florida that decided the last election. And I suspect that Nader is going to make some hay out of this. And what it really reminds me of is Hubert Humphrey in 1968. Mm. Only Humphrey was loyal to the president of his own party's war. He hugged Lyndon Johnson's war. And it was only in the last week of that campaign when he made a speech in Salt Lake City and he came out for an exit strategy, peace talks, that he started to go up in the polls. Mm. Kerry is embracing the war of his opponent.
We can't hear from Hubert Humphrey tonight, but we will hear a little bit later from Ralph Nader. Dan Payne, let me turn to you. How do you interpret this? John Kerry had the whole weekend to think about President Bush's not-so-rhetorical question to him about how he would vote now. He must have sat down with his whole crew and then stood up at the Grand Canyon and said, I would vote the same. What's the political calculus here, Dan?
Well, I don't know what he or who he consulted with or how he made the decision, but this is as far as I can tell, and I don't necessarily agree with the decision, but this is the same position John Kerry has had for months. There's nothing new here. He has said all along, I voted to give the president the authority to go to war. He said it on 60 Minutes 3 weeks ago, I believe it was, when he was pressed by Leslie Stahl. He said, knowing what I now know, I would have voted the same way. Bush now is criticizing Kerry for being consistent, for staying with his position on the war. I don't quite understand. I respect Jack's opinion about the politics of this, but I think Kerry, who takes foreign policy very seriously, has thought long and hard about this. And I don't think he's taken this position lightly or under the spell of the Grand Canyon.
Peter Kanellis, Jack Beatty has it mindless, craven, and impolitic. How do you read Kerry sticking with this and saying so strongly, even if I had known everything then that I know now, I would still give this authority to the president? How do you interpret what he's up to here? What's he looking to achieve?
Well, for one thing that I don't agree with Jack on is I think that Kerry still has a lot of room to attack Bush on Iraq, and I don't think he intends to just sort of neutralize the issue by marrying Bush's position. I think that he has always said that the vote to authorize the president to go to war was a vote to pressure Saddam Hussein into allowing inspectors back and revealing his nuclear intentions. So when John Kerry says this is an appropriate power for the president to have, I think that that's pretty much where he's putting himself. He's saying the president in these kinds of national security situations should have the power to go to war. What they do with that power should be how the president should be judged, and Kerry intends to spend a long time attacking Bush on what Bush did with that power.
But, Peter, I have to say, we spoke with a number of folks in Washington today, some of them so disillusioned with this comment and the sort of clean, exposed clarity of it that they didn't even want to talk about it. They were disassociating themselves from the Kerry campaign today, saying this is exactly the kind of authority that presidents shouldn't be given. This is central to George W. Bush's preemptive warfare strategy. This is not what John Kerry should be embracing. Do you really believe that he's on the same page with George W. Bush about preemptive war? What was it about that authority that he thinks is so important for George Bush to have had?
Well, keep in mind that that Kerry's vote was before there were any arms inspectors in Iraq, so people were sort of flying blind. Now, you know, there's this sort of trick of the retrospective question that if he knew now that there were no WMDs in there, it's sort of a hard kind of question to answer. I suspect that John Kerry probably wanted to say, hey, wait a minute, that's tricky. In hindsight, who knows?
Peter, hold it there. We'll come back. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about why John Kerry is sticking with his Iraq vote despite all we have learned. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about why John Kerry is standing by his October 2002 vote authorizing the Iraq War. I'm joined tonight by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty, by Dan Payne, Democratic strategist and media consultant. Peter Kanellis, Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe, is with us. Ralph Nader and Sidney Blumenthal will join us shortly. You can join us as well. John Kerry says if he had it all to do over again, he would still authorize President Bush to go to war in Iraq. Do you understand why? What is John Kerry proving with his unshakable embrace of the green light he gave to war? And is this a principled position, a political calculation? Is it winning your vote? Campaigning in Pensacola, Florida today, President Bush spun Kerry's defense of the vote into full-throated approval of Bush's Iraq war.
After months of questioning my motives and even my credibility, Senator Kerry now agrees with me that even though we have not found the stockpile of weapons, we all believe we're there, knowing everything we know today, he would have voted to go into Iraq and remove Saddam Hussein from power.
But John Kerry is still questioning Bush's motives. Under pressure to answer for that vote, Kerry fired back with a volley of questions he wants the president to answer.
Why did he rush to war without a plan to win the peace? Why did he rush to war on faulty intelligence and not do the hard work necessary to give America the truth? Why did he mislead America about how he would go to war? Why has he not brought other countries to the table in order to support American troops in the way that we deserve it and relieve a pressure from the American people?
John Kerry on the rim of the Grand Canyon with questions of his own for President Bush. Dan Payne, take us into this Iraq thicket now. It does seem to me to be getting pretty thick in here. You've got George Bush now kind of proudly running on the Iraq war, even though the weapons didn't show up, the Al-Qaeda connection didn't show up. He seems to be posing prouder than ever about it. And John Kerry's still standing up for that authority, even though the stuff didn't show up either.
Well, Bush is stuck with the war, and he really might as well embrace it fully because he's going to be the war president, even if he calls himself a peace president periodically. I'd like to go back just a step to what Jack was saying before about the craven political maneuvering behind Kerry's statement. You know, Kerry is taking a politically risky position. The simple position, the one that would be politically helpful to him, would be to say, oh, I really don't believe that I knew enough and I probably would have voted differently. That's the easy way out. He's taking a much tougher line here. And he's saying, as he has all along, that if voters believed that he would take America to war the same way as George Bush did, then vote for George Bush. But he knows that people understand that as a soldier, as somebody who has worked for peace, as somebody who understands the military budget, that he would have administered this war in an entirely different way. In fact, we don't even know whether it would have wound up being the same kind of war at all.
So his calculation, you're saying, is that he can't back away from the war. Why? Because he would look like a flip-flopper, or because Americans, swing voters, support the Bush assertion that the world is better off without Saddam Hussein there, or a strictly principled position?
I think this is consistent with what he has been saying all along, that the president is entitled to have the authority under these extreme conditions, and that he just thinks the authority was misused. And, you know, there are people like Tommy Franks, who was in charge of this war.
Yep.
In the early months, who are saying, you know, today, I believe it was, or maybe it was yesterday, that Kerry is absolutely qualified to be the commander-in-chief. So the question of whether he's fit to administer a war is something that voters will have to decide. But I think, frankly, people who are concerned about the war are going to find John Kerry and understand his position better than pundits do at this point.
Peter Kanellis, how do you read what's going on here? Is there a kind of jujitsu underway? John Kerry gets in close to George Bush on the vote authorizing the war, and from that position he's more capable of criticizing the conduct of the war? Is that the play?
Yes, I think so. I think that he's going to sort of position himself as a person who is as tough as anyone on terrorism and who believes in strong presidential action and who believes that when necessary we will take preemptive action. But George Bush botched this one up. And it's a way of preserving his credibility as a fighter of terrorism, but also giving himself full license to attack Bush.
Jack Beatty, so there's the analysis. He's staking out a strategically workable position here that gives him a chance to work on George Bush's war record.
Well, yes, I think he will try to do that. But, you know, the conduct of the war really isn't the point. And, by the way, it's disingenuous of him to imply that he would have got together the Allied coalition that Bush couldn't, just as it's disingenuous of him to say, I will reassemble that coalition to bail out our troops once I'm elected. The fact is the publics, the European publics, were not going to let their leaders do any more than what they did. Those leaders didn't do what they did because they didn't like George Bush, but because they didn't want any part of this war, and because they saw it rather as Richard Clark has seen it, as a divergence from the war on terror. In fact, Clark put it this way. He said at times he thought George Bush was channeling Osama bin Laden. And in that sense, I think we have Mr. Kerry now channeling him too. The ground to be against this war on is, my gosh, it's the wrong war in the wrong place against the wrong enemy, and it's doing nothing but making more enemies for us. And if Kerry can't say that, which is the most sensible and security-conscious thing, it seems to me, you can say about this. I mean, is his mind just completely hostage to his sense of political calculation?
Dan Payne, what about it? We do hear even Republicans now saying, oops, that may not have been the best thing. That may not have advanced our national safety overall. Odd to hear Republicans saying it and not the Democratic challenger for the White House.
Well, I still believe that he is being consistent with his vote and with his position, that the easy way out would have been to say, oh, I changed my mind. I don't think the facts were what they were at the time, or I was deluded or whatever, and I would like to, you know, repeal everything going back to my vote. He's taking a tough position and a politically risky one by trying to stay consistent with his notion of presidential authority. And it's a hard position to stick with because Bush is a master at shorthand and at positioning the war in Iraq as simply bringing down Saddam. So Kerry's left with trickier footing. I don't know that he can be absolutist in either direction. He can't say I endorse everything that Bush did, and he can't say I disagree with everything that Bush did. He's trying to preserve his right as a potential president to exercise the authority of the office, while at the same time, as Peter was saying earlier, giving himself plenty of running room to talk about what's going wrong with this war and how absolutely dangerous it is for the United States, not just in the short term, but in the long term.
Well, we'll see if George Bush rises to that. Certainly, he seems to be having the more fun of it right now in his rejoinders to John Kerry. Dan Payne, Peter Kanellis, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Washington, Ralph Nader, independent candidate for president. He ran as the Green Party candidate in 1996 and 2000. He's author of The Good Fight. Welcome, Ralph Nader.
Thank you very much.
You've seen the reporting, no doubt, on Senator Kerry's remarks on the Iraq War and his vote authorizing it on the rim of the Grand Canyon. What do you say?
Well, first of all, he made the wrong decision in October 2002. Article 1, Section 8, gives Congress, and Congress only, the authority to declare war. It is not delegatable. It's not something you can assign to the president to decide. It's not just a technicality. So once you get in a bind the way Kerry did on the war resolution, then he has a problem being steadfast. And being steadfast means that when your president gives X number of bases for invading Iraq that turn out to be fabrications, deceptions, if not outright lies, repeated again and again, then as a challenger to the president, what he should have said was just that it was a mistake, and Bush is responsible for misleading the public and for inducing the trust in what Bush said to the public. That's what he should have said.
But is there a winning political path in that direction, Ralph Nader, or does that leave him should have, but losing?
Well, first of all, it's the right thing to do. You plunging a nation into war based on fabrications, deceptions, and lies is an impeachable offense, in my opinion. It's hard to find a more impeachable offense than that, given the thousands of deaths and injuries to our troops and the tens of thousands of deaths and injuries to innocent Iraqis and the increasing magnet of our troops for recruiting grounds for stateless international terrorists over there, making the situation even worse and setting the stage for a boomerang back onto our country in terms of our national security.
But of course,
is it the popular thing? Of course, it depends on the way he said it. He shouldn't have responded when he's looking over the Grand Canyon. That's not the right time to...
A little tipsy from the heights.
Well, you can say that, but Bush put out some bait for Kerry, and Kerry fell for it. And you don't do that, standing with one leg on a rock looking off over the Grand Canyon. You've got to have a very measured statement so you don't look like you're a flip-flopper and say it in a way that resonates with the growing body of American opinion that wants the troops back yesterday, or if not yesterday, thought it was a mistake to send the troops in the first place. And that's now up to 55% and growing.
But Ralph Nader, now John Kerry's changing this a little bit. For a long time, what he seemed to be saying was, I authorized the president to do this so he could put the pressure on Saddam Hussein that would reveal whether or not there was a lethal threat buried somewhere in Baghdad or around Iraq. These were extraordinary circumstances. Was that not a reasonable alternative?
Not in the light of his lack of objection when the troops were ordered in the invasion. I don't recall John Kerry saying, hey, that isn't what I really meant. No, he went along with everyone else. When the president speaks, the people are supposed to follow, even over a cliff. And a lot of members of Congress are susceptible to that invidious practice.
So how do you think John Kerry is calculating to make this statement now? And now, not only saying that we needed the leverage to find out if there were weapons there, saying even if we knew they weren't there, and even if we knew there was no al-Qaeda connection, I still would have given the authority. How do you interpret that, Ralph Nader? What's he up to, in your view?
Well, he can't interpret it because it's too nuanced for a presidential campaign where some of the most malicious attack dogs on the part of the Republicans have been unleashed on him and his record in Vietnam, et cetera. This is a very dirty Republican campaign, to say the least. And he simply can't stand up and say, well, what I really meant was I wanted President Bush to have the tools to make his words be backed up by the threat of military force, but if no weapons of mass destruction were found, and if no ties with al-Qaeda were found, and if it wasn't found that this tottering dictator presiding over a dilapidated army wasn't willing to fight for him was really no threat to his neighbors, much less to the U.S., then if all that was the case, then, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. You've basically got to say, you got to go on the attack, and you got to say, the president committed a serious breach of trust with the American people. He plunged the nation into war on fabrications, deceptions, lies that are thoroughly documented in the mass media and in former intelligence officials and former advisors to the White House on terrorism, and he should be held accountable for it. That's going on the offensive if he doesn't want to go to the next step and say he should be impeached for it.
Dan Payne, what do you say? Ralph Nader says John Kerry is too nuanced, and he's too nuanced in the interest of the wrong thing anyway, presidential authority to go to war, not congressional.
Well, I think it's easy at this point for Ralph Nader, who didn't have to vote and was not a candidate for president or even contemplating a run when the votes were cast, to say, well, it's clear now in perfect hindsight that Kerry made the wrong vote, and now he should repeal everything that he said, including that vote afterward. That kind of hindsight is perfect, but isn't available in the real world.
It was foresight. I was against this war from the get-go.
But
if you don't know that, if you don't know that, don't assume the opposite.
Well,
I spoke all over the country against this war when the drumbeats were undertaken by Bush. You could see the signs of our country heading for the cliff on this. I saw it very, very early. I opposed the war resolution. So let's not talk about hindsight. Continue your discussion.
But, Dan Payne, let me put this question to you again. Is John Kerry too nuanced by half here? He's getting kicked around by George Bush on the basis of his response today. I don't know if the president will even respond to Kerry's questions. Are they just a little bit too sophisticated?
I guess I haven't made my point clearly enough. John is being absolutely consistent with what he has been saying all along. This is not a new position. This does not deviate from his vote. It doesn't deviate from anything he has said in the primaries or anything he said at the convention. The fact that Bush has decided to turn this into a Q&A session long distance doesn't change the fact that Kerry's position is essentially the same as it was in October 2002. It may be that he that there are extenuating circumstances here that have completely changed America's view of this, and I think that in fact is what's going on, and I give Ralph Nader credit for helping to move the country in that direction. But it doesn't mean that John Kerry can't explain his position. He's never had a position that said it was the wrong thing to go to war. So by saying I'm essentially sticking with my guns on this doesn't hold water, doesn't make him susceptible to Bush's complaints.
And Peter,
from his own point of view, John Kerry is letting down the growing body of opinion against the war that is growing because millions and millions of Americans, not just the organized anti-war movement, think that the fabrications matter. They think that discovering no weapons of mass destruction, discovering no threat to the neighbors by Saddam, discovering no connection with al-Qaeda matter. They matter. They matter for reconsidering positions that were too trustworthy on Capitol Hill, too trustworthy of George W. Bush.
Ralph Nader, let me ask you a final question because we're going to a break here very shortly. You are still a candidate in this race. When John Kerry embraces this position, embraces that vote, does he swell your vote? You may still swing this election to George Bush. Do you feel a bump coming out of these kind of comments for the Nader candidacy?
Well, we certainly are the only anti-war candidacy Nader-Kameho ticket, and it goes way, way back. It's not Johnny-come-latelys, and we know a lot about this area. I know the language. I studied the area. I studied the region. I knew the mistakes that Bush was about to make. I knew the kind of reaction that was going to receive our troops, not with flowers and garlands and huzzas. But, you know, just as an American, I winced when I saw how Bush put out the debate and Kerry, a debate rather, B-A-I-T, and
yep.
Kerry fell for it. I mean, that's not the way to respond to Bush. You have to go on the offensive against Bush. You've got to show steadfastness because he's already, John Kerry, getting this rap, which is very hard to shake, of being a flip-flopper, of being indecisive. When you're dealing with an attack dog, you got to go after him like a wolf.
We hear it. Ralph Nader, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Ralph Nader, independent candidate for president, author of The Good Fight. Dan Payne, Peter Kanellis, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about John Kerry and why he's sticking with his Iraq vote despite all we have learned. You can join the conversation tonight. Could John Kerry distance himself from that vote and still win? Did John Kerry give Ralph Nader a bump yesterday? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about playing Iraq in the presidential campaign and John Kerry's fresh embrace of his green light for the Iraq war in October 2002. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you understand why the Democratic candidate is sticking to that position? Is this a position John Kerry has to take to fight for the middle? Deniacs, are you tearing your hair out today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And callers, we will get to you in just a moment. I apologize for the delay. We're joined tonight by Dan Payne, Democratic strategist and media consultant, Peter Kanellis, Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe, our own Jack Beatty, and right now from Washington, Sidney Blumenthal, former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton, author of The Clinton Wars, currently a columnist with Salon.com. Sidney Blumenthal, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So we've just heard Ralph Nader bemoaning John Kerry, making that vote in the first place and sticking with it through this campaign, saying it's just too nuanced, people don't get it. Do you think he's right to stand by his green light vote for President Bush on the Iraq War? Is it making sense?
Well, I'm amused to hear Ralph offering political advice to John Kerry. I've known Ralph for decades. Long been an admirer of Ralph's until fairly recently. I brought him into the Clinton White House to help us on the issue of global diseases. He was actually reluctant to come in and involve himself in constructive activity, but I got him to come in. I heard Ralph say that Kerry was, quote, too nuanced. I heard George Bush today say, my opponent has found a new nuance. This is a Republican talking point. I heard Ralph say that it was a dirty Republican campaign, to say the least. Well, if anyone should know, it's Ralph, since he's paid for and organized by the Republican Party right now. His entire effort to get on the ballot is funded by the Republicans. A Republican consultant in Nevada was behind his effort there. There are prominent Bush pioneers funding him. He has been rejected by his Green Party, and he's basically thrown himself at the mercy of the Republican Party and hoping that he can be put on the ballot through Pat Buchanan's Reform Party, a party that is anti-abortion, has called for troops on the border to stop immigration.
So we've got it. Sidney Blumenthal is no fan of Ralph Nader, but we really want to focus on John Kerry tonight and why he's standing by this vote and whether it's making sense for him politically. What do you think?
I believe that Kerry has no choice. He can't retrospectively reverse a position that he took in the past in good faith.
Not even in light of all the new information that's come out since October 2002?
Politics, you should never reply to a hypothetical.
The absence of WMD is not hypothetical,
though. There's another past. Now, here's the deal of what Bush was setting him up for.
Yeah.
Bush was setting him up to be a flip-flopper. He wanted Kerry to say that now, in the light of all evidence, he would have voted differently. That's what Bush wanted Kerry to do. That would have advantaged Bush more than any other position.
And why? Play that out for us.
Because then Bush could say, see, he really is a flip-flopper. He doesn't take any principled position. You can't count on him. Even on a matter of war and peace, he reverses himself.
But a lot of Americans have reversed their position on new information, too.
On the war, not only in Iraq, but his standing on Vietnam, where, remember, Kerry came back and was anti-war in a principled way, and he would have tried to discredit him on his own personal history. And even when Kerry failed to fall into Bush's trap, Bush still used the same rhetoric today as though he had. He just has his talking points, and he's willing to say them cynically, and that's all he's got. This is a candidate in a more serious level who is not running on his record.
Sidney Blumenthal, stand by. Peter Kanellis, Dan Payne, Jack, I want to finally get to our callers. Frank's calling from Fairfield, New Jersey. Hi, Frank. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. I'm an independent who was a anything but Bush vote. However, Kerry lost my vote today.
Why?
Where's his guts? Where's his political guts? Nader was right. You know, whatever happened to right and wrong? Admit a mistake was made. Saying, if you knew now what you knew then, think about it. No WMD. No connection with Al-Qaeda. No threat to his enemies. No threat to the U.S. And you would still vote for that war? So what is the reason to go to war? What would the reason be? Admit a mistake, go on the attack, and just do it. You know, just be an aggressive attack dog. I'm going to hang up now and listen to your response.
We've got it, Frank. Thanks for your call. Sidney Blumenthal, there's a voter. What do you say?
Well, you know, in fact, you can't relive the past, and Kerry actually can't go back and recast this vote. What he can talk about is what he does now. And
but he's just participated in that exercise. He has gone back. He said, if I knew then what I know now, I would still vote the same way. He has gone back.
Well, he can't change his vote in the past. He has to stick by what he's done. And in fact, no one knew about WMD. Everyone assumed that there was WMD. The intelligence was skewed and distorted and twisted, and people were lied to. You can't engage in hypothetical votes and transport yourself through a time machine. The important thing is that Kerry asks the right questions now and is not caught and trapped by this utterly fabricated, phony issue of Bush to try and move some small percentage of voters who get worked up over this wholly political issue that lacks substance about what we should do in Iraq and Bush's own record.
Wholly political, and yet the WMD aren't there, neither is the al-Qaeda connection. But we take your point and we hear it. Sidney Blumenthal, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Sidney Blumenthal, columnist for Salon.com, formerly senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and author of The Clinton Wars. Hashem is calling from New York City. Hi, Hashem. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I'm really puzzled by Kerry's position. I only think that he agreed with his staff to say that, as you said, not to have Bush saying that he is really a flip-flopper, but this is a huge mistake. It's a strategic mistake due to the fact that most of the people who are undecided, if they will, and probably they will vote for Kerry, it's because of his anti-war or anti-what happened because of the war. But now he put somebody like me in a very bad position. I'm stuck. If these two nominees, Bush and Kerry, are pro this war, which has no basis whatsoever, then who am I going to vote for? Nader said before that he's not thinking that he will win the election, but he's there to make a point. I'm paraphrasing what he said.
Yeah, Hashem, we've got it. Let me put it to my guest, Peter Canellis. I hear you there.
Yes.
So here's yet another voter saying, all right, this isn't what I want to hear. And yet, presumably, John Kerry thinks this is good politics.
I think that there's a deeper context than people have been talking about tonight. The larger picture is that Americans remain very concerned about terrorism. People feel it in their bones. They know that there are threats out there. And they want their president to have the power to deal with them. And on some level, going back, even if it's retrospectively, and recasting that vote and taking the power out of the president's hands feels weak. It feels like some sense of abdication to our enemies. And I think that Kerry has made it very clear that he wants to be an aggressive, vigilant fighter of terrorism, matching Bush point for point on that level. And he can't go back.
Jack Beatty, is this the winning formula for the Democratic contender to say, yes, we need to concentrate more power in the hands of the president, Republican or Democrat, because we're in a new era now. We're fighting terrorism. And goodbye to all that.
Well, Robert Byrd was eloquent on that program on our show a couple of weeks ago and on that point. And his book, I'm very glad to see, is on the bestseller list. In the Senate, when Kerry was casting his vote, saying, oh, I'm giving the president authority so that he can get those inspectors in, and this is not in any case an endorsement of war, Robert Byrd was saying, don't kid yourself, senators. You are voting to send young Americans to their death. This is what this is about. We don't need to do this. This isn't where our enemy is. Our enemy is al-Qaeda. This is a diversion. So Kerry can't say, well, I was just, I made the best judgment. Lots of senators, three-quarters of the Democrats in the House made the other judgment. His own senator, Edward Kennedy, made the judgment against the war. 20 other Democratic senators did. Kerry didn't, and it stands out in his whole career as the great exception. I mean, he was against Gulf War I. Why? Well, they couldn't run for president in 92 because he was. So he was not going to make that mistake again in 2002.
Dan Payne, you're describing this as a demonstration of strength, but could it not also look like an abdication of congressional responsibility?
Or maybe a certain stubbornness. I think that the callers and some of the people, including Nader, who are unhappy about the war, have really fixed the blame on the wrong guy. If you're troubled by the war, its conduct, the phony rationales, for God's sake, don't give Bush any credit for anything. Vote him out. And what's the best way to vote him out? Vote John Kerry in. So that's a simple political calculus in my book. It doesn't get much simpler than that. And as I said before, Kerry has said, if you think I would conduct this war the same way as George Bush, then vote for Bush. But we know the public doesn't believe that. They're putting their faith in a change. And John Kerry, we shouldn't forget, is a soldier. He spent an important part of his life fighting a war, and it conditions the way he sees the world and the way he feels about the soldiers who are over there and their families. And he's really got he's got a slightly bigger view of this than what are the politics at that particular moment.
So he's going to look strong, and he's going to, he would say, do it differently. Andrea's calling from New York City. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
I was just calling because I wanted to address something that one of the speakers said earlier about Kerry. I know they think that it's a nuanced argument or something like that, but I think that I don't think it's very nuanced. I think what it's going to do, unfortunately, is that a lot of people are going to be worried that even if Kerry conducts this war differently than Bush does, that he might abuse some of the presidential power that Congress has been giving the president recently in the last couple of decades. And that's very fearsome for a lot of voters. They want to see somebody, I think, who's willing to admit when there was a mistake and is willing to take some changes on that. So,
and you want to see that presidential power reined in, not expanded. We've got it, Andrea. Thanks so much for your call. I don't want to end this hour without giving some attention to John Kerry's questions at the rim of the Grand Canyon. George Bush is not the only one who can ask them, though his are typically shorter. He had one and one pretty short one. John Kerry had four, and they were tough ones. Jack Beatty, I think we've got to, you know, put this in the pipe and smoke it as well. He says, my question to George Bush, one, why did he rush to war without a plan to win the peace? Two, why did he rush to war on faulty intelligence? Three, why did he mislead America about how he would go to war? And four, why has he not brought other countries to the table to support American troops? Those aren't bad questions themselves, Jack.
No, they're not. But as I said, the last question about bringing other, you know, troops along is disingenuous. The answer is the foreign nations didn't want any part of this. And the idea that somehow Bush could have worked a coalition, that was off when the French foreign minister turned to Powell at the UN and said, we're not going to go to war on any basis. It just wasn't on. And he's just keeping the illusion going there because he taps into it with his campaign promise that I'm going to get the Europeans to come in. And as to this other idea, rush to war, well, wait a minute. Who helped him rush to war? It wasn't Robert Byrd. Robert Byrd, with our last caller, was saying, wait a minute, it's our job in Congress to declare war. We don't delegate that to the president. James Madison warned against that. He said that gives the president the terrible temptation of war, war for political reasons. And Byrd said, let's follow our constitutional procedures. So I don't know if there was a rush, Kerry helped rush it along.
Peter Canales, last question goes to you. Do you think John Kerry is still reading the political tea leaves correctly here? American death toll in Iraq climbing, still so much trouble there. Poll numbers showing increasing disillusionment with that war. Is he still getting himself on the winning side of the issue?
Yes, I think so. I think that if he had gone back on that, that vote, as Dan pointed out, he would forever be branded as weak and a flip-flopper. And I think that, as I said before, people want a president who's going to take action, and they don't want to have the president's hands tied.
So the candidate speaks power to power, and that's John Kerry at the lip of the Grand Canyon. Peter Canales, thanks a lot for joining us tonight. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Peter Canales, Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, and Dan Payne, Democratic strategist and media consultant, has advised John Kerry on past Senate campaigns. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
And Jack Beatty, there we are, another day, another soundbite out in political land, this one echoing across the Grand Canyon.
There really is a debate going on between these candidates right now. They're just not in the same studio.
Well, we're helping it. We're facilitating it. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Tamar Morad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Cora Peterson, and Ann Stevenson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.